Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy. We are the Bella Lost Souls podcast. This is episode 155. I got a really special guest interview to do after this first little intro of the show, but I want to introduce you to Justin Troop and Andrew Whitaker.
I have 141 and two-thirds chance of winning.
Short for 40K. What's up, team?
And Ricky Addington.
This isn't where I park my car.
No, this is not. Hey, look, thank you for coming. We're not recording on our normal day due to some technical difficulties, updates. Look, I'm not a scientist. All I know is it didn't work yesterday. Today it seems to be working. And Ricky was available, so we grabbed him.
I love that. I'm not a scientist. It's right up there with my favorite, like, you know, caveat. Like, I'm not good at math, but... We found Ricky Addington.
And so, those two things really matter together.
He's actually relevant because he's throwing a tournament in his scene pretty soon, right? When's the date of that tournament?
That is, let's see here, it's going to be October 22nd.
So not too far away from now. And it's in, where is it?
It's in Kingsport, Tennessee. So Tri-Cities area, right there where Bristol is, Virginia, Tennessee state line. It's about 5 hours, I think, from you guys.
You guys have a great scene up there. But more importantly,
it is totally coming to that. October?
October 22nd.
Well, it's a primer for Warzone. These guys are using the Warzone missions or whatever we have published by then, the rules of engagement, and it's going to be a mini Warzone event for people to kind of get in that scene, their hands on the missions and maybe play them if they're not doing some independent playtesting on their own.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big thing for us is, you know, we really strive to stay in the middle tables when we go to Warzone. So this is just a chance for us to get better. You know, we don't want to go too hard, you know, get those top tables. We want to make sure we can back off and just stay the
throttle
course.
It back.
Yeah,
enjoy
yeah,
the middle
yeah,
tables.
Yeah, Tom Collins will take care of most of that for me. But
even if that happens, you know, thank you for helping get the word out there and create the enthusiasm in your area, and just again just and coming down to the event ultimately too. That's really meaningful to us.
Well, it's the best event in 40K. You know, it's I plan my entire social calendar around it. I don't know if that's good or sad for me, but it happens.
If all your friends are there, you know, that's fine.
Yeah,
it's good enough.
I
do want to talk briefly about Warzone, though. Is that we're adding more Friday night events to the schedule, and the bugs are not worked out of this one yet. It is going to happen, but there will be a Horus Heresy 30K kill team event on Friday night.
Sign me up.
You got to take Friday off. You got to get there Friday, like during the day proper. Check into your hotel around lunchtime on Friday and really get the weekend started properly. I mean, if we're going to do big time events on Friday night, you know, it's the biggest part. It's the biggest party in 40K, right? Like that's how the event is promoted. And if you're going to party, you got to get there during the day and get your head right. So that's pretty awesome.
And 30K, while it's a balanced game as a whole, like if you were to take a 2,000 point game or what a 2,500 point game, it's pretty balanced. When you get down to the 200 point, 300 point level, this is what I'm thinking about doing, a 300 point one that's themed off the Battle of Isfahan 3. That was the first. That's where in the books, where Horus actually turns on the loyalist Marines for the first time.
And now I got to put Loken together, Paul.
And then sends down. Yeah, then he sends down Angron, or Angron actually just gets kind of frustrated that things aren't happening quick enough, and Angron joins the fight by himself. It's very,
yeah, no, they did. They did not send Angron. Angron sent Angron.
Yeah, that's true. I want to have that be the theme of the battle, and then I want to take it a step further. And this is all in kind of the works, but I want the winners of the game to be able to decide whether or not they are loyalist or heretics. And then the loser of the game is the other side. So going into round two, the winners have chosen their allegiance. The losers of the first game their allegiance is chosen for them.
So I can, in theory, be a traitor Space Wolf player.
Yeah. Yeah. And as much as it pains me to say, you could be a traitor Blood Angel. But the real fact of the matter is that you're probably not a traitor. You are just acting on orders of a traitor and doing some things you probably shouldn't have done. But the fog of the war is in place and, you know, things happen.
Hey, man, when bullets are flying overhead, sometimes it's a little chaotic.
Well, I mean, I'm not justifying it. I think it may be realistic and plays into the grittiness of that book and that novel and the kind of where the game is and wants you to go. So anyway, this is in its infancy. If somebody says that's just a crazy idea, but I don't, and it has a reason other than they just don't want the potential of their legion fighting, you know, playing on the heresy side. for the a round two, hey, then maybe just win your first game and you can do what you want.
It's motivation.
Yeah.
Get good.
Yeah. But it'll be a very casual event too. It's going to be on Friday night, hopefully starting around 5 o'clock on that Friday on, that'd be what, November 11th. And then go until 9, 10 o'clock. Their start times, of course, subject to change when we get everything loaded in, but not by much. The idea is to have everything moving and be able to play while the X-Wing event is going on as well.
You know, it's actually funny. The draw of weekend tournaments are what they are. You know, two 3-day GTs have a great draw to them. But with Friday night, if you're going to commit your Friday night to actually do additional gaming, there has to be a really cool thing happening, if that makes sense. Like, you have to actually have a really, like, when I go to a 2-day GT, for example, the Forge the Narrative seasonal up in Raleigh, I guess it was last January or something like that, or if we had a Friday evening event, I probably wouldn't have participated in it because I was there to play 40K that weekend. But I think the feel and aesthetic of Warzone lends itself well to a fun Friday night event where you're like, you know what, I'm just going to go hang out and not be cutthroat competitive, but just go hang out with my friends. And Kill Team is a great way to do it because the games are an hour long. You're moving around the room. It's low model counts. So that's a big draw. I'm down with that.
Cool. Yeah. I hope you come and play in the event. I don't know what the rules are going to be yet, because there's a lot of that imbalance is really at the low points in that. It was kind of, I did not expect to see it until I'm like, the support weapon squad can have 9-10 plasma guns at that point level.
That's going to be fun. just kind of what people create, you know, like that's going to be interesting.
Well, there's going to be some restrictions put in place to make the game, just to make the rounds fun. That's just it. It's to make every round fun and to represent that whole shattered legions type stuff where you're running around the battlefield, scooping up allies as you can to go on and take that next hill or whatever.
Yeah, I'm digging it, man. I'm going to need to put some wheels on the X-Wing table that I'm at, though, because I'm going to have to cart that around.
Let's get a Segway. I think you can rent those down here.
Just going to move between table and table. I'm going to lose all my games now. But
Troop, I think you could pull a Bobby Fischer and just play multiple games all at the same time.
Just hire a valet.
Like, you know, as long as you trust your opponent, you can, like, walk away from the table, play your X-Wing round, come back, do your Kill Team round, and go back and forth between systems and beat multiple opponents.
I go with it. Bobby Fischer, valet, or Segway. I think those are the three things.
I'm just handing out headlocks on all different game formats.
Anyone who's purchased a Friday night event ticket already, like if you got the VIP ticket to Warzone, you can use the VIP ticket for any of the basic Friday night events. We may add some Friday night events that have a different cost applied to them simply because the logistics of what they are. Like, we are considering offering an LED class, like how to LED up your models, by a very accomplished LED person here. You've probably seen, saw his Army, Joe Johnson, saw his Army at the ATC. Dude knows what he's doing. He was an RC person before he got into Warhammer. And you want to talk about an expensive hobby, RC.
Mm-mm.
Very expensive. But anyway, he's very, very good. So we're trying to get everything in place to offer more to that. So where I was going with that, though, is any Friday night ticket that you've already purchased or will purchase will get you into any Friday night gaming event. And if we are able to put together any type of workshops or whatever, the cost is still in flux on that. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff we're thinking about to make available.
I'm calling this a convention now.
It's
no longer a GT. It's a convention.
My goal is to make it as convention-like as possible. And so the next year, it's even more convention-like. And, you know, it comes with good stuff and comes with bad stuff, but mostly good stuff and a destination, things to do and hang out.
It's not a convention. It's not a convention until we have lanyards, Paul. You have to have something on a lanyard. That way people know it's legit.
I'm with you. That is a very valid thing to say. Speaking of things that you can do and get, though, we have Forge Narrative has t-shirts available now. And today I cobbled together a shopping cart on ForgeTheNarrative.net. You can go to the FTN merch section and then order shirts in your size.
That's what I'm talking about, man. I'm wearing one right now. And I love it. I actually own like four of them because I don't own any other t-shirts.
The first batch went out earlier in the week, so the people that ordered them off the last time we talked about it on the show should be getting them in hand pretty quickly or pretty soon if they haven't already. So anyway, they're there. We have an inventory, and this is just to show support for the show. You know, we want you to wear it, be your gaming shirt, but it's also a way to say, hey, you know, we dig the show. Thanks for putting it on every week. I'll wear the shirt every night. You know, don't wear it. Maybe give it to your buddy as a gift. I don't know. Do whatever. Just so you know. Really happy, to have them to be able to sell to you guys.
Yeah, a nice thing too is like, so when we're at like Adepticon or LVO or any of these other events, and if you're wearing your shirt to these events, we can spot you. Like we don't know everybody, right? Like, I mean, it's too hard to know everybody. But if I can see that you're wearing a Forge Narrative shirt, I'm literally walking through the crowd.
That's the same person you can stumble to, and they may get you back to your hotel room.
One of us.
Yeah, man. It's part of the family, man. And I love that. Like, it just makes that much more fun. You know, you meet people at these events. We all have that common thing. Let the show be that common thing. So when you're at these events, if you don't know anybody, you see other people wearing these shirts too. So you have that common thing right there. Use that to bridge the gap. Bam, have some drinks.
Couldn't have said it better myself. There's an inventory of them available for purchase on the website. It's forgenarrative.net. Go to the FTN merch page, and the only thing in there currently right now is t-shirts in various sizes. If you don't see a size there that's for you, let me know and we'll figure it out. But I think there's a decent variety of stuff up there right now.
And this is much better and more efficient than selling them out of the back of your car. So
that's a respectable step up. That is a time honored tradition.
I bought my very first LeBron James jersey out of the back of a guy's trunk outside of a YMCA.
Totally legit.
I just
completely authorized.
Hey, it's got a hologram on it.
Whatever. I'm not getting disbarred for it at this point. Past the statute of limitations. It's fine.
Well, yeah, enough about that. If you guys have any questions about the shirts or any kind of merch or whatever, you can hit us up on the contact page or in the Facebook, or which we actually just crossed 6,000 likes on the Facebook.
It's a not inconsequential number of people.
Yeah, I think that's nice. And again, it couldn't do it without the people listening and, of course, without you guys here kicking out content on the show. But enough of you. I've heard enough of you guys for at least 15 minutes. I'm fortunate enough to be able to sit down with Nick Keim. You guys might recognize his name from writing the Salamanders novels.
Good series of books. I've read two-thirds of the whole thing.
I love them. I mean, Deathfire was a great book. Vulcan Lives, another good book. Vulcan wasn't like my jam. Like, I didn't have any like feelings for or against Vulcan. He just was, you know. But then you start hearing this stuff about his gene seed and his abilities or not abilities or whatever the case may be. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but it got me to read the book largely because I get a new book every time I go on a plane. It's even better if it's a Warhammer book. Matter of fact, they're 99% a Warhammer 40K Horse Heresy novel when I get on a plane. And that happened to come up in the rotation of the Vulcan Lives. I loved it. It was great.
Yeah. Nick really writes well, you know, the Salamanders, for people that don't know, like a quick fluff thing about them, like they're like the champions of humanity, you know, like they will sacrifice all for you. And it only needs to be one of you, you know, the whole chapter will die in your honor if they can ensure that you lived in and all that stuff. So that's kind of like a neat thing, you know, and the way that he writes that, it's not too holier than thou feeling, you know, like sometimes you get that from some of the other chapters.
The idea of them doing a service. They are not like, well, you're not going to do it yourself, so I must kind of thing. It's like, that's just in them to do that kind of thing.
You know, yeah. It's funny. It's funny that that's in the grimdark universe of the 41st millennium. Like the Salamanders are the closest thing we have to serve and protect from our own lifestyles or from our own existence, right? Like the notion that these incredibly powerful entities are here to actually make sure that regular human beings live is an awesome thing. And the first time I ever encountered Salamanders in any of the fluff was actually in Hell's Reach, which is the Black Templar book about Grimaldis. And there's a great scene when these Salamanders have arrived and they're basically, and the Black Templar are trying to like counter assault the orcs at Hell's Reach, and the Salamanders are like, no, we got to stay here because if we counter-assault, we'll be out of position and these people might die. And Grimaldis and his squad of Black Templar are just baffled by this, such that they were almost disdainful of it. And the Salamanders seemed very understanding. And it was just a cool thing. And like, it frustrates me because the Salamanders are so bad on the tabletop. Their chapter tactics are just
atrocious. Used to be. They used to be a very much of a go-to chapter.
Well, yeah, because the way the old
Twinling Melta and Thunderhammers.
Exactly, right.
Like, I mean, that's yeah. Yeah.
Who's to complain about that? Exactly. But in the current meta for the last basically 3 years since the introduction of chapter tactics, the Salamanders have been terrible. And it really pains me because I think the color scheme is cool, the fluff is cool, they're relatable, they're the one like shining bright spot in the grimdark 41st millennium. And I think that the guy, you know, this particular author has done an excellent job highlighting them.
Yeah, he's great. And he's also really fun to talk to. There's a moment in here, I don't want to spoil it. Let's just say I had some kind of like personal vindication while we were talking about the origin of a certain phrase you guys may have heard of. Anyway, I'll leave it for that. Let's let Nick do the talking here for a few minutes, and then we'll come back and then talk about, because the Tyranid fact came out this week. And man, some other Marine stuff. I think we have to talk about it.
I got some words.
See you in a bit.
FTN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to a segment on Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy. I'm joined today by Nick Kine.
Hey everybody, nice to be here.
Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
We're all big fans of your novels and the Horus Heresy, so that's why we're talking right now. I know you got a lot going on, but I want to talk some about the stuff that you've been doing and how you got involved in the Horus Heresy. Sure. And maybe why you picked the Legion that you write about the most, and kind of hear about your involvement in that.
Well, obviously I'm well known for the Salamanders. I can talk a little bit about that if you like.
Please do. I mean, that chapter, of course, before it was a Legion, in our minds, a chapter.
Sure.
It has, people love it. It's people know him as the Champions of Humanity, one of the ones that cares so much more about us mortal folks than maybe some of the other Legions did. And then something that people have been a fan of forever, so they already had their perceptions about it. So was that kind of intimidating at all going into it?
In retrospect, I think it probably is a bit intimidating.
I don't want to put that on you for the next one.
I think I've done enough now.
Yeah, you have.
To get over that. But at the time, because I first started writing Salamanders for 40K rather than Horus Heresy, and at the time they were very much a blank slate. There wasn't actually that much background written for them. And I just really started to break into 40K writing. Prior to that, I'd done a lot of Warhammer books about dwarfs in forges and with fire. So I'm guessing there's like a connection.
It's a smooth transition for you.
There was some familiar aspects.
We need somebody who can talk about hammers and fire.
Yeah, I kind of fell into that bit quite easily. Oh, this feels like relatively familiar territory. They're just not vertically challenged like dwarf. there's a lot of similarity. And the humanity aspects of the Salamanders definitely appealed. I thought that was really interesting. My editor at the time, Lindsay Priestley, we had lots of conversations about what would a Salamanders story be like, what a Salamanders book be like, how would they act as a chapter, or what would make them different to Ultramarines, Imperial Fists, Blood Angels. I think at the time there was maybe one short story that had been written about Salamanders by Gav Thorpe. Really cool story, which I read prior to writing Fires of War, which was the first short that I did. It's a long short, it's about 20,000 words. I think you could tell that I was itching to write a novel because of the burgeoning sort of size of the short story. And it was the blank slate aspect that really kind of attracted me to them. It was like an opportunity to do some proper world building, bring in some interesting characters, bring in some interesting aspects of their culture, bringing in the idea of sanctuary cities. I got a lot of great support at the time from chaps like on the internet, like Argos and Piriel, that really were extremely supportive. They were fans of Salamanders before me. They had a lot invested in an author writing about Salamanders, and I've dedicated some of my books to them because they were a really great source of information, kind of helped keep me kind of on the straight and narrow as far as Salamanders was concerned, because there was a lot of new ground, and there's certain things that certain things established with the sort of the tone of the 41st millennium, the 40K sort of setting. There's certain things that help kind of guide you as far as what what's the Space Marine chapter like. But when you're getting into the detail and the nuance of actually what makes a Salamander, and hopefully that's the thing that has risen, that's made them more prominent, I think, as a chapter. And I like to think I've had something to do with that, that folks are more aware and interested in Salamanders because of the work that I've done. But I very much see that as, certainly early days, very collaborative effort with the support from those sort of guys.
I love what you've done with the Salamanders. I think the book, the last Horus Heresy novel I finished was actually Deathfire.
Yeah.
Great novel.
Thank you.
I think the characters in that book, you really understand their plight and what they're going through with their Primarch. And I know the Primarch is, he's a character in the novel without actually necessarily being in the novel.
Sure.
Is that difficult to write? Because you are, because they're, I mean, they're all personalities and sons of their father and what yeah. have you, so you can link it back to that. But yeah. how have you written Vulcan to be a character without him really being in there?
Yeah, so. His presence is definitely felt throughout that book. Yeah. And the entire story is essentially, it's about bringing a parent home to die, effectively. Obviously, Vulcan is dead in the story, and they're not going off on any kind of conquest. They're not crusading. They're not even not even really taking part in the war as such in this book.
That's something that's very, and I don't want to get into the spoiler territory, but after they get to the point where they can make a choice, do they go this way or this way? And that, I didn't expect that chapter to be as engaging as it was.
Okay.
Was there ever a point where you thought that they were going to go the other way, go towards the battle?
Yeah, well, I think... No, there were lots of little choices. I think you don't know. You've got lots of options, sometimes two, three, four different strands you could potentially take with characters and with the story, where I genuinely didn't kind of know until I kind of got there. I was about to get there and go, okay, I think this is the right thing to do. But that one, I knew what was going to happen, but it was important to the character, particularly Numion, who is the focal character for that book. And he's kind of a cipher for his father's kind of emotions and standpoint, I think, a lot in the story. And there is,
this is a great character, but also, I mean, the reluctance to do some of the things that maybe other people want him to do doesn't seem contrived. It seems like it's an actual something that the character is dealing with. And that has a lot to do with the way you've written it. I think it's amazing.
Thank you. Thanks very much. One of the things I did before starting Deathfire is very much it's a book about grief and acceptance. And I've still got it on my writing board. Actually, I haven't taken it down yet. I wrote down the steps of grieving.
Yeah.
And if you go back through the book, you'll see those articulated through Numion.
Step 8, don't go to Terra.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was his kind of, his kind of Garden of Gethsemane moment where he has an option. It's almost like, this burden is too much for me and I can't do anymore. I just can't do anymore. Is it okay if I don't do it, Father? Can I take this option rather than this really painful one? Because Numion kind of, again, without spoiling the story, Numion kind of knows deep down what the end is going to be. That awareness is, hopefully this comes across, that awareness grows as the story develops until it reaches the finale. The moment where he has to choose between sticking with the thing that's hard and doing the thing that's easy and actually going to Terra is kind of the easy option.
Well, you're a soldier. You're like, there's fighting going on. Our job is to fight. Let's just do that.
There's some guilt wrapped up in that too.
You know? Yeah. And that's what I'm talking. It's all there on the page. Yeah. And you feel it. It's a real meaningful moment, I think, where it could have been just well, of course that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Because that's what the story's about.
Yes. No, absolutely. And I'm glad it comes across that way. It's very much meant to be. It's a very difficult choice for him to make, because on the one hand, you've got, especially bearing in mind the Salamander mindset, the Nocturnian mindset, this idea of selflessness, self-sacrifice, that kind of thing, putting others before, you know, putting the needs of others before your needs. And that's very much about what Nocturnian culture is about, particularly the Salamanders. And by making the choice that Numion does, at least on a kind of an internal level, he is putting himself there. It would be very easy to go to Terra and say, let's take part in the war, let's burn out in a great pyre.
Yeah.
And feel like
I see what fulfilled. You did there, by the way, but I agree. It's a good analogy.
Yeah. It was liberal. That was always the moment, the decision moment. I think everything that builds up towards that is intended to make it feel like that decision for Numion is a very difficult one, particularly because he has to make believers out of his companions, in terms of, you know, what he thinks is going to happen and what he wants to happen to Vulcan. He's desperate for it to happen. He's desperate to think there's, it's a very much a book about faith as well. And I don't mean in terms of necessarily faith in the emperor, but belief in something that there is no empirical evidence for, that you can't see, that you can't
feel. That gives you your reason for being. I mean, that's really the case. And I think that's what he links it up to. Now, with Vulcan, he has a lot of dimensions that we might not have expected before the novels occurred. Him also being, one of those being him seemingly immortal.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, it was actually during a Horus Heresy meeting. So I'm sure your listeners will have heard before about how the Horus Heresy writers will gather together and discuss ideas, discuss the shape of the series, individual books they're going to write, that kind of thing. And I was coming off the back of, this is Vulcan Lives, where this was established. So I was coming off the back of writing a whole bunch of stuff about salamanders. I think I'd written Promethean Sun at the time and some short stories. And I very much wanted to do some material with Vulcan in the Horus Heresy, because part of my research for the 40K books was Isfand V and what the salamanders are like now in the chapter. It's very much, even though it's a 10,000-year gap, it's very much still affected by kind of what happened, you know, way back then. So I really wanted to visit that as an idea. And look at Vulcan as a character. And I was trying to think about, well, what can we do to elevate, to give Vulcan, his own kind of unique shtick, I suppose. What kind of makes him compelling and interesting as a character in his own right? And how does he epitomize, the values of his legion? Because they were, laid down by Vulcan. I think a lot of folks will know that the salamanders were on a very destructive kind of path because of their sort of never say die kind of approach to battle, and this idea of self-sacrifice had reached a point where they almost did completely sacrifice themselves. And I think Vulcan was the sort of the tempering element in that equation. But to go back to the original question, which is how did it come about? I literally just suggested it in a meeting. And I was kind of a little bit trepidatious, because there's always that risk that by saying, oh, I want my Primarch to effectively be an immortal, it's like, well, you're just making him like the best Primarch. You're turning him into Wolverine. And what I kind of tried to convey was, well,
you could just say Wolverine is cool.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But he's not Vulcan, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's I love Wolverine. He's great. But I wasn't trying to turn him into Wolverine. It was giving him a burden. And I like the idea, and this is something that I've promoted in the books, that Vulcan was the one Primarch, or one of the Primarchs, certainly, probably who feels this the most. He kind of wants to hang up his sword at some point. He fully expects the war to end.
He wants to crusade, do the job of the Emperor.
Yeah, sure, he's loyal.
Give the peace, create a better hope for humanity.
Absolutely. And I don't know, go to a farm or something.
Yeah.
I don't know, who knows what he's going to do.
His business.
Go to, absolutely. Absolutely, set up his own sort of forge shop. who knows, but his expectation is the war's going to end, and he wants, to be at peace. And because he is immortal and the war isn't going to end, he never kind of gets that. So it's less about him being uber powerful and more about it being a burden of it's never going to end for me.
The novels do a good job of showing that yes, he will come back from most things. I won't say everything, but a lot of things.
Yeah.
But then also not making it to where it's a combat advantage that that short circuits battles or challenges. No, it never does that. I don't ever feel like it does that when I'm reading it.
That was never the intent. That it was that was the case that he'd be killed and miraculously come back immediately. It certainly in Vulcan Lives anyway, the intent was to keep it very, very mysterious about how it actually happens. And we don't kind of know, because you get the inevitable questions of, well, you know, what if he's completely like vaporized? How does he come back from that? What if he's chopped up into like 100 pieces and scattered throughout the galaxy? How does he come back from that? And those questions were asked at the time, along with, the other writers sort of lampooning my idea and shouting like stuff like, Gordon's alive.
I wasn't going to mention that. Okay. I mentioned this on the show, but I wasn't going to mention it to you.
Yeah, sure.
That, whenever I see Vulcan Lives, to me, it's like Hawkman from Flash Gordon just saying, yeah, you know, yeah, hail yeah. Ming. Like, okay. You know, yeah, so but I'm also, I love the concept, and I understand, and I really understand the context in which that is. But then you hit me with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let me start over with that.
Yeah, sure. It's kind of, it's an obvious one. The thought of it, I mean, I love Flash Gordon. I watch it every Boxing Day. I'm a huge fan of that movie.
I love it. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
It's great, right?
It is.
And so naturally, when thinking about characters coming back seemingly from death, the Gordon's alive line kind of just happened. And then obviously that changed to Vulcan's alive. And then we changed to Vulcan lives, which became the title of the novel, which at first actually had an exclamation point after it, which thankfully went away, because I think that perhaps would have taken it probably a bit too far, been a bit too campy. I wanted it almost to be, it was actually Dan that suggested this. He said, well, look, why don't this, that's a really cool idea. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. Why don't you turn it into like, sort of a, almost like a battle cry?
Yeah.
Like, even though the Salamanders kind of know that, or some of them at least, I think that Vulcan's been destroyed, and that happened several times.
I think you even talk about it. It becomes something along the lines of like, that's, they're trying to make peace in some capacity with themselves or their brothers or whatever when they say that.
It's kind of like a shout of defiance, whether or not the individual Salamander believes that Vulcan will come back or that he's still alive or that he's dead. It's the thing that kind of unites them. The Vulcan lives is that defiant shout, which is almost like, kind of no surrender, never say die.
Yeah.
We'll endure no matter what. All of that stuff is wrapped up in that phrase. And so it went from being a kind of a quirky reference to an extremely campy 80s film.
Easy.
in the best possible way, right? I'll just say again, Flash Gordon, awesome. I love that movie. To something which had a little bit more depth and a little bit kind of more meaning to it. So I'm absolutely down with folks kind of saying Vulcan's alive and doing it in the hot.
We're gonna make that happen.
Fantastic. No, I'm good with that. I'm absolutely at peace with that. I think that's cool. Because it's referencing something that you know I really like and reminds me of my childhood as well.
So, yep.
And a lot of these stories, these ideas, these notions of what a kind of heroism is and what sacrifice is comes from that point. I think when you're younger and you're watching it, you know, heroes in action on TV or in the books that you read. And naturally, a lot of that stuff is going to come out in the writing, because I think a lot of writers are like sponges for that stuff. You know, you absorb everything that's kind of coming around you, the experiences, the people that you meet, your own life experiences, the stuff that you read, the things that you see, the music that you listen to. It all gets kind of dragged into the vortex. And it's kind of swirling around, and then the blank page on your laptop or your notebook, whatever you use, that is the repository for that stuff to just kind of come out, and you know that's where it's from. So when I was kind of reflecting on it later, it's no great surprise that some Flash Gordon kind of came out in that story.
I'll take it. I feel better in knowing that's the case. I mean, it makes I'm glowing on the inside right now knowing that's the case.
Awesome.
I know we're running short on time, so we're going to wrap up. Sure. Is there anything else you'd like to cover right now before we wrap up?
No, that's great. Thanks very much for having me. I'm really glad you enjoyed Deathfire, and there is going to be at least one more installment of that particular storyline. I don't know if that's an exclusive thing to say or not.
Awesome.
But the way that the book ended, there is.
It opens the door. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. We'll talk soon.
My pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
We are back. I'm still TPM. I got Andrew Whitaker and Justin Troop.
Guys, I think we're working here.
Bang, bang.
And Ricky Addington.
Andrew Whitaker broke the internet.
I believe that we pulled you away from a game, Ricky, and I apologize, but, you know, the show ain't going to record itself. I'm glad you're here.
Truth.
I hope you guys like, when you hear it, the interview I did with Nick. He's just a cool dude. Like, cool. I didn't have any expectations of him because I didn't know him. I never met him as a person, but I did like his writing and I like his style and like his kind of his the way he goes about getting in the mind of the Space Marines that he's writing for. So the interview ended up being pretty interesting. I hope you guys liked it.
Oh yeah, I'm digging all of these interviews. Actually, like all the time that you got to spend while you were up there in Nottingham at Warhammer World, it's so awesome to be able to get this information from all these different sources. Resources, shouldn't even say sources. the brilliant minds that create this universe that we love, if you're able to sit down with them and kind of like feel them out and get some answers to some of the questions that you might have, it's just awesome. It's a great time to be a part of this specifically, but you know, just to be able to listen to these things as a fan, it's amazing.
So in this segment, we want to talk a little bit about tactics around, especially about Tyranids, because they just got their FAQ drop. And we're going to round the episode out with a little bit of hobby talk. We're going to call this thing the finishing moves, where we talk a little bit, try to make talking about paint drying not exciting radio. I mean, I think we all can agree on that.
Challenge accepted, sir.
Yeah, but I think we can give a few tips to help get people, you know, just that little bit of confidence to do some of these things they might not already be doing. So we'll save that for later in the show.
I mean, talking hobby on a podcast is difficult, but this is as good as it gets for podcast hobbyists.
But hey, we can talk tactics and we can talk FAQs. And the Tyranids got their FAQ this week, and it is, let's just say, short. And I've got my theory about short FAQs, but there are a couple of things in here which I think are one is a game changer. One specifically, and we'll talk about that first. The first thing that's a game changer is that spawned gaunts from a troop choice Tervagon count as being objective secured.
Well, let me just stop you right there before we get any farther in this. It's spawn troops from any Tervagon. An HQ Tervagon spawning a troop choice will be objective secured. They say that in that FAQ that if your Tervagon's in the HQ slot and you spawn gaunts, they're still FAQ. So you don't, like, that's, I mean, a subtle but very important difference, saying that no matter where, doesn't matter what slot the spawning unit is from, the spawned unit has the detachment bonuses of its slot, if that makes sense.
No, I get it. And that is incredibly strong. And I think that, this is coming off of big bugs that don't have the ability to shrug off things because they have armor. They're right in that still able to be still jeopardy of grab weapon range as far as their armor goes. They're only toughness 6, and they've got 6 wounds, which are not difficult to chew through in today's world.
Right. Absolutely.
So that's perspective. So that's just a little bit of perspective on top of this awesome thing that I think we should talk about.
Yeah. See, what I like about it, though, is this is the screw you to Gladius. You know, this is like that answer back. You're pumping out 3 dice. You know, you're rolling 3 dice, so you're averaging about 11 or 12 bodies every turn. You know, hopefully you're not rolling doubles and you cause her to stop spawning.
Per Tervagon, and you can take several of them.
Yeah, you could span this out, and you can flood the field with OBSEC. And, you know, honestly, a 10, 12-man unit of gaunts isn't the most game-changing thing in the world. But come late game, when you spawn these things, you hid them, you maneuver them around, and they're sitting on these objectives, and the opponent has nothing left to dislodge as many bodies that they need to do, this could, in theory, be game-changing completely. And I can't wait for some of the bigger-named Tyranid players out there. You know, we all know them. We all know their names. I want to see what they're going to start doing and showing us in the next, you know, we got Nova coming up and a couple other kind of bigger tournaments that are
Warzone. Absolutely.
Warzone, I think we should have a pretty good, strong Tyranid showing there by a couple players.
Oh, so. There's lots of people that have had their Tyranid army just on the shelf for a while. I mean, there's hardcore Tyranid players, but they haven't been playing the power because the power's not where they wanted to be.
I think the big thing of this is that it gives a Tyranid player, whether it's a top tier talent, whether you're a top 10% guy or a bottom 10% guy, doesn't matter. It gives the Tyranid player an option. Whereas previously, if you wanted to be competitive with Tyranids, you must, like, your option was flying monstrous creatures, namely flying Hive Tyrants. With this, it opens up that door. You know, obviously the guy who won Battlemaster last year at Wars in Atlanta, good friend of the show, good friend of all of us, Price Wilkes, he took four or five Tervagons to ATC not more than 2-3 years ago. And it's a competitive list. Good players can absolutely use that as an option and maybe bring ground bugs back into existence. And this FAQ, with a single stroke of the pen, with a single answer of a question, gave Tyranid players a very, very valid ground option.
Let me read the full question here, just so in case someone only read half of it like I did in the beginning. If a Termagaunt is taken as a troops option, per the Scuttling Swarm rule, and spawn Termagaunts, do these new models have objectives secured? That's the first question. Do they have objectives secured if they were spawned by a Termagaunt, which is an HQ choice? Yes to both questions, as long as the Termagaunt is taken as part of an attachment that confers the objective secured command benefit. For example, a combined arms attachment.
That's huge. That's awesome. That's so great. I love it. As a guy who never has owned a Bug's Army and never will own a Bug's Army, I love this.
But don't you want to know that they are out there and they are? I mean, they're so much built into the 40K lore at this point. I would like to see that type of variance on the table.
That's what I'm saying, though. Like, I don't have a dog in this fight in terms of like what Andrew Whitaker is personally playing with. I just love to see an army get this huge, awesome buff.
And I think that's the biggest complaint I've heard out of our Tyranid players is that I can only win if I'm taking Flying High Tyrants. Everybody's playing the same list. So this right here, all of a sudden I can have that iconic Tyranid swarm coming across the table at your Marines. That's awesome. Well, that's what
one
Tyranids
of the main
are.
Reasons too to take those Hive Tyrants is because they were an easy way to get the Electroshock grubs, and the Termagaunts can also get the grubs.
And that's a solid way to compete with Space Marine Gladius, Dark Angels Lion's Blade. It's free points. You're spawning free points, and it's objective secured. You're spanning free objective secured. It is exactly what Space Marine Gladius does. It's a little bit more random in its generation, but the variances are very, very good.
You can't turn yourself off too. So it's
you certainly can. But it happens,
it could easily not. You could easily go a whole game without doing it.
Exactly. You roll 2-3 turns of 4-5-6 on the die roll, and you're pumping out units of 15 plus gaunts, and you're just like, wow, it just floods the board. I think the
math supports it being a very solid tactic when it does things like this. And the reason that we all categorically dismissed this as being objective secured is because in our minds, in our tournament minds, that the combined arms attachment or the allied attachment specifically stated things purchased out of this organization of boxes. And anything summoned or spawned or brought in the game later wasn't out of those categories, wasn't purchased out of those categories.
Yeah, and you just, I think, I'm sorry, just real quick, I got to jump in here. The word you just used, Paul, is what really has competitive players kind of quaking in our boots, right? Because I'm less concerned about this buff to Tyranids, because as a bottom tier codex, if you buff Tyranids, they just get a little bit better. When you say summoned, I think this is a clear indication from Games Workshop that summoned units are going to get this. We have yet to see the Demon FAQ, and I'm purely speculating here, but if it turns out that summoned units gain the benefit from whatever detachment summons them, then that's going to be a real problem. That's going to be a serious
problem.
That's
confusing problems, what that is. Because there's lots of demon detachments that confer rules.
even if you just take Pink Horrors and a CAD, and now you're summoning out units that are, you summon other Pink Horrors, you summon other, Plague Bearers, whatever it is, and now you can start spamming. And demons are very, very efficient at spamming summoned units. And if their objective is secured, that is going to be a meta-changing list. Guaranteed.
Agreed. I don't want to necessarily get too speculative because I could easily see this being something that's special to the Tyranids and specific to the Termagaunt from a fluff and background perspective. I could just see that. But to your point, though, I can easily see the parallel in comparison to this thing brought something in after the game started. These things are bringing things in after the game started. What's the difference?
Right. It's going to be a tough line to draw. And if they draw that line, I'll be okay with it. I'll be north to south on it either way. I'm just saying, I'm foreshadowing a future episode of Forge the Narrative where that's going to be a thing.
Where we're all talking about our demon armies?
Exactly.
Very, very fair. This thing, it's a game-changing thing because it now forces you into situations to where you have to deal with stuff. Objective secured will win games. It will still win games.
Yeah, period.com. Yep, period.com. You can't You cannot deny the power of objective secured, especially in the way that all these different tournaments are structuring their mission packets now. Progressive objectives, holding an objective late game, it doesn't matter. When your fast attack slot is sitting on an objective and I walk over there with one freaking objective secured body and I win.
I mean, it's obviously not the magic bullet all the time, but it definitely can pull. If it's a close game, the guy with the most objective secured is probably going to win.
Yep.
Yeah, that's solid, and this helps that. And I think that this helps a lot of Tyranid players who were playing this type of strategy before, but it just fell out of being a very, very effective.
Well, I think, you know, it's going to cause people to start looking at objective secured more, really. I mean, because, you know, if they start spamming everything out, this is creating units, whereas Gladius and Lion's Blade, well, you're whittling away my units. My units go away fairly easily. Five-man squads, Razorbacks, Rhinos, Drop Pods, whatever. Those go away fairly easily throughout the course of the game. I just have a lot of them. Whereas the Tyranids here, and if this happens with demons as well, which would be insane, you're creating more and more and more throughout the game, and Space Marines can't compete with that as far as, you know, Gladius and Lion's Blade.
Obviously, like, we're extrapolating this FAQ and applying it speculatively to a different FAQ. And that's obviously, like, Paul's skin is crawling at us.
I never want to influence someone's purchase.
Paul is the politically correct Warhammer 40K podcaster, and I get that. But, like, really, like, the ramifications of this ruling are very, very large. But even within the Tyranid Codex itself, it cannot be understated. I mean, a Tervagon is 195 points, right? That's it. 195 points, which seems expensive until you realize that it's a 6-wound, toughness 6 entity with a 3+ save, and it's spawning units every turn. So for
it also isn't terrible in close combat by the sheer nature of its stats.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean,
it's not great. You're not going to quake in your boots, get into it, but it could do something that you maybe not expecting.
For one, it's a psyker, right? It's an ML1 psyker. That's a big deal, which means you can potentially give yourself feel no pain and do all the other stuff that's, you know, Tyranid psykers can do. It has scything talons and whatever else, you know. I always bust on my Tyranid playing friends because they say these things like, I have scything talons. Or
you're just looking at the model like,
what does that even mean? I don't know. Yeah, like,
sure
you there's no way to end a conversation faster than to talk about Tyranids. Like, I don't but, you know, it has 5 attacks on the charge in close combat at AP2 and strength 5. Like, that's a big deal. Like, you can't just willy-nilly charge that with 5 Marines and think to yourself, oh, I'm going to win this combat. No, you're not, right?
Like, I got a couple of crack grenades bound to do the job.
You've got one crack grenade. Thanks, GW.
One now.
You've got one. Yeah, like, it's a big
deal. You're versatile with Smash, too, though, so, you know, you can't discount Smash.
Yeah, that's where I'm going. This guy could roll up on a pod and crack it himself. He could roll up on a Land Raider, put a hull point or so on, you know?
Yeah, yes. And since it has such a high attack profile, having your attacks doesn't hurt, or halving. I don't know how to say that word
you're
properly.
You're talking about the smash. The current smash is you trade all of your attacks for a single smash attack.
You don't even get a bonus when you charge.
Yeah, you don't even get the bonus, right? You're thinking 6th edition smash.
Yeah.
Man, I need to read a book.
You trade all the attacks. And again, it's not even +1 for charging. It's not like I charge in, I get a +1. Nope. Figure out what all your attacks would be, trade them all for that one.
I recant everything I just said.
I mean, but it is an AP2, you know, so it's nice.
See, there it is. There's Paul Murphy patently finding the silver lining in whatever terrible rule.
Well, I'm just saying, if you've got a, let's say, for instance, you have a drop pod you're trying to kill off a progressive objective. This guy can conceivably do it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. And I think that a Tervagon's ability to kill small units of infantry, you know, do real damage at AP2 against heavily armored infantry. And at the end of the day, it's a T6 6-wound model. That's not easy to kill.
I don't know. Today's meta, though, T6 is not what it used to be. And that's another thing is why Carnifexes suffer, because they're still on that kind of, hey, T6 is awesome train.
Well, to their credit, though, monstrous creatures can still get toe and cover, unlike the gargantuan counterparts. So if you're really concerned about, for example, Grav that doesn't give a two toots about T6, you can still get toe and cover. And then against, for example, you know, the strength 6 spamming armies like Eldar, when you're wounding on 2s as opposed to wounding on 4s, the math changes so dramatically on a plus armor save. So it's a big deal in certain
instances. And if they're wasting time, like kind of half killing your Tervagons, that's giving you more time to churn out the gaunts. I mean, there's not really a better choice there. So what do I do? Do I try to half kill this guy, or do I kill the units of gaunts he just spawned?
Absolutely.
You know, true. You're creating some decision points. Anytime you can layer in those decisions for your opponent, I think you're doing good, because there's a chance they take the wrong choice.
And especially at sub, you know, I take four of these Tervagons at sub 800 points. You know, I can pack in a lot of really lethal Tyranids for 1,000 points, and then have the other 800 points be just Tervagons pumping out gaunts. I think there's an effective list build in there, and with one swift stroke, GW gave Tyranids players a big option.
Yeah. Well,
and
let's talk about Molochs too, because they got affected by this fact. Now, it's unclear if people were or were not playing this way on the global scale. Anyway, you know, again, I could be wrong, but I don't even know it, because it rarely comes up in games around here. But here's: can a Moloch arrive from D-Strike Reserve via Tear from the Deep onto units in combat? The answer is yes.
That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, because they're all in there, packed in, ideally, to right there under that pie plate.
Yeah,
six AP two.
I think that wording is fairly clear.
But the next one is: can Lookout Sir rolls be made against the wounds inflicted by the Moloch Terror from the Deep, and can this ability be used on invisible units?
That's the one that matters to me.
Lookout Sir rolls can be taken, and this ability can be used against invisible units.
That's awesome. That's great.
That's a big one. I want to mention something real quick, and I don't want to make the Tervagon topic come back. We touched that pretty good. But think about with the implication of being able to do this blast template into combat, you're spawning dudes, tying up a unit, and then you can pop them off with these Molochs.
Getting them to pack all – because that's what I do with the zombie horde. You get them to kind of group up because they've got to consolidate into combat. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to drop this stuff on you.
Yeah, that's a good combo tactic to think about, you know, when you're starting to develop the layers of how you want your list to work and designing it to how it's going to interact on the table. And it might be a combo. Like, it might legit be something considering.
I don't want to read too deep into it, other than the fact that it says you can tear from the deep onto units in combat. What else would it mean?
Well, yeah, I think that – so there's some of these FAQs, you know – so happy with Games Workshop for answering these questions, for engaging their player base, and really, like, these FAQs have been 100% awesome, with a strong 90% positive outcomes. But there's a good 10% that are like, well, you've created more questions than you've answered.
Well, that's why they're in draft form. I mean, this is why they want to get more questions, get more feedback, and then put something out that's ultimately more playable and exactly what the community's been asking for.
Absolutely. And one of those questions, I think, that just came to my mind while I'm thinking about this Moloch, excuse me, I'm going to say Trigon. That's not right. Moloch. You see the problem with bugs. They're like, who even knows what we're talking about? The Moloch thing. So say hypothetically I have a Terror from the Deep thing that pops up, and I'm hitting Kodiaz with a squad of, I don't know, Ranger. Adeptus Mechanicus guys, right? You can't say it's Kodiaz with a single Adeptus Mechanicus Ranger. Well, it says you can look out, sir, the Moloch attacks, right? Okay, great. So I pop up and I roll to wound. I wound Kodiaz and I wound the Ranger. Well, so can the Ranger, can Kodiaz look out, sir, his wound to the Ranger? Yes, this FAQ says yes, you can look it out. Okay, cool, great. So Kodiaz looks at his wound to the Ranger, and the Ranger dies. But the Ranger already had a wound allocated to it because I wounded him as well. So now the question, it's a order of operations question. Well, if I can look out, sir, this, then Kodiaz looked out his wound, and the Ranger died. And then the wound that was already allocated to the Ranger just disappears into thin air. How does that work? I you know, with those blast weapons, the same question with Stomp, okay, right?
That's a good question to kind of throw out there to see how other people are playing it. I'm of the opinion that the wounds do not go away. They just circle around and beam the next unfortunate soul that happens to be in the unit. If there's nobody else, then it loops his butt back around.
And I think that's a fair way to play it. I mean, I think GW,
for instance, with a Imperial Guard command squad. the one guy, the senior officer or whatever, you shoot it with an assault cannon. Or the carries assault cannon, gets six wounds on it. He's like, well, these five guys behind me, one of them's dying twice.
Yeah, I mean, with the carries, because with shooting attacks, it's a little bit more clear because you take them one at a time in the order from which, like, you know, who's closest to the assault cannon, right? You take them one at a time and you kill guys as they are the range.
You're right.
The assault
cannon. You can't. I see where you're going with that.
Blast weapon, it's a little bit more ambiguous. And again, hearkening back to the stomp question, we had this come up the other day with stomp. Like, if I can look at a six on a stomp chart, who or whatever, if I can look at a stomp roll, you know, what's the order of operations? And I think GW has said, like, the player whose turn it is decides the order of events. I'm like, well, you know, whatever. I'm not picking, it's whatever. It's just like there are always going to be gaps, and that's a rules question that this a Moloch rule popped into my head.
I think the Moloch rule is great. I think that the any questions that it does bring could be somewhat easily adjudicated quickly and moved on if it comes up in a tournament or whatever. Everybody knows how they
whatever
play.
Ricky decides, I'm down with.
Hey, yeah,
just because he'll come to my table and say it in that sweet, sweet Virginia accent.
There you go, fellas. It's going to here's what I'm going to tell you. You can allocate. Yeah.
See, I don't even know what the substance of what Ricky just said. I just heard the voice, and I'm down.
So the Tyranids, you know, we got all kind of rumors and more Tyranid stuff. I mean, if you had to ask me, I think that smaller facts doesn't mean that there are less questions in the book. One, it probably just means less people are playing them, which is a good indication it's time for some revamps. And, you know, with the idea that maybe more Gene Stealer cult stuff is coming down the line, maybe we get more interaction that makes a little bit more sense, I think, with how we understand the Tyranids to work. I do understand the wanting to separate some of the IP to make it be its own thing. But I think a lot of people will be happy having these Gene Stealer cult hybrids working with the Tyranids and stuff in harmony.
Yeah, I was kind of frustrated when the Gene Stealer cult and the Tyranids turned out to be allies at convenience.
Yeah,
they should be battle brothers. It's irksome to me that they're not.
There's
but
probably
it
some
made
grand
no sense.
Design that we're not appreciative of right now, and we might not ever be. I still think that these guys are supposed to be the vanguard for the Tyranid fleet, and that's the way I want to see it. But, you know, I'm also willing to accept change as long as it's cool.
I want their limos back.
Yes.
Give them their limousines, and I'll take out as a convenience.
All right, we have just a little bit of time left, so I want to talk about this segment that we're going to try to incorporate into every weekly show, and that's the finishing move segment. Last week, we talked about weathering. We talked about how to overcome that anxiety of laying some weathering on something that you've already painted. You've got it to the point where, hey, this looks good enough. I'm ready to put it on the table. And you're like, you know what I need to do? Trash this thing out a little bit.
Got to do
it. It's just dirty it up some. You know?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it looks more realistic. Sometimes it fits the theme. And we talked about, like, just don't do it on one figure. Maybe it stands out a little bit. Unless it's, your Inquisitor's mudden truck. I don't know. But it looks better when there's a theme of the weathering throughout the army using consistent colors. This show, we want to talk about the glow effects, what people refer to as object source lighting.
Yeah, I feel like it's intimidating for real. I mean, this is one of those ones where if you don't approach it with the right mindset, you potentially can have to repaint a model. I'm interested to hear about everybody's viewpoint.
The most terrifying thing I ever did in this hobby was that Lancer after mounting that thing and doing all that work my Lancer.
Be more specific, Ricky. We all know what you're talking about, but you got to like tell the people at home, the folks listening in New Zealand, to tell them what you're talking about when you say that Lancer.
Okay. So I have an Imperial Knight Lancer and a Cerastus pattern Lancer, and it is, God, I don't even know how to describe it. I've got imposed jumping off of a ruin with the lance charged back like he's getting ready to knock Adam Abramowitz out, which it did not do in that game I'm mad about. He's basically posed leaning forward on one leg, and I have about a pound and a half or something of weights in the base just to keep this thing up. It's crazy. But so I did all this work to it, got him painted up, decals on it, all the stuff, and then it came time to hit it with the OSL and make that shield glow and make the lance glow. And
like
it's
from the
terrifying.
Center where it looks like maybe the shield generator thing is going.
Yeah, yeah. The shield has these cool little, like, it looks like little emitters around it on the outside. And then it's got like this cool little, looks like some sort of generator or something in the middle of the shield. And so, you know, the shield isn't a solid thing. It clearly has like an energy field or something, you know, is what it's supposed to represent. So it's, you've got to represent that somehow. So I was like, well, I'll try OSL. And so it was terrifying to take this model that I had worked for weeks on and then start hitting it with splotches of blue and white paint, which, you know, could potentially ruin your entire model. So,
well, I mean, long story short, it looks good. It looks very, very good. So getting over that, a little bit of anxiety to get this on the model, I think, was the important part. And there's lots of different ways you can do it. You can do it with an airbrush. You can do it with a paintbrush. You could do it with washes. And I'll go ahead and just share a quick story about, I'm painting a plague furnace, a Skaven plague furnace, and it's got sensors with floating smoke off of it, and it's throwing.
Things looking good.
It's throwing this glowing green ball of I don't know. My youngest calls it the
warpstone.
Warpstone. I'm not the Skaven player. I'm painting it for a buddy, but it's launching this ball of warpstone or flinging the fog. I don't know what it's doing at the enemies. But anyway, it's got all this kind of supposed to be glowy and smoky and stuff. And the way I did on the smoke and even part of the glow was I use it with a series of dry brush. First, what I did was I laid down a dark gray and then I dry brushed on a light gray over the whole, a medium gray over the whole thing. And then on about the top two thirds, dry brushed a kind of a lighter gray and then white up at the very top. And then I put a coat of green wash over the whole thing. And it really just, it brings out that highlight. The whites, everything turns a shade of green at that point in time. So you get that kind of glowy kind of spectral effect. And that's something I did with only brushes and only technique. No natural talent involved in any of that at all.
I just wanted to say, you sent me a picture of that when you were working on it. And my first impression was, who painted this for you? I didn't know you could paint that well, Paul. I mean, the grav guns on those Ravenwing bikers I loaned you, you've definitely stepped up your game for that,
well,
friend.
Okay. Got those grav guns, it was the night before the tournament. When I got those bikes.
No big deal.
It was the night before the tournament. So, you know, compromises had to be made.
Yeah, they were. Good.
It is funny the way that, what do you call it, Ricky? OSL, object source lighting. This is, I think it was last week, we talked about effects painting and weathering. And I made the comment, a somewhat snarky comment, about how nobody goes in and finishes their model and says, I'm done with this, and sends a picture to their grandmother, and then decides, you know what I'll do? I'll slap some effects paint on this and weather it. Because weathering is part of the plan, right? Yeah. OSL is, I think, different than that, or I think, you know, glow effects are different from weathering, because weathering is, you know, you can integrate it as you paint, and there's a corrective way to do it. But what Paul just described, and what I've kind of been a big fan of, is the dry brushing glow effect. I mean, if you look at my Vestroians, for example, my Vestroian Imperial Guard, the plasma gunners have glow effects, right? The plasma chambers on their big plasma guns have a glow effect, and it's all dry brush as a dry brush and wash combination. And as soon as you start dry brushing, that's very difficult to fix because it gets everywhere, right? I mean, it's like you start scraping paint across.
Anybody can do, like anyone can.
It's not difficult. It's certainly not difficult, but it is it's an all or nothing proposition in terms of end result. And so, unlike, in my opinion, weathering, where you don't get to the end of the model and decide, all right, now it's done, I'm going to go ahead and slap on some weathering. No, weathering is always part of the plan. But with glow effects, you can literally get to the end of a model and say, wow, this model is perfect. It's done. And then be like, well, I'd really like to make this plasma gun glow. And there's a come to Jesus moment where you have to decide whether or not you're going to start dry brushing that model. And like what Ricky described with that, you know, that Lancer, you know, you put so, I mean, you've probably got what, 40 hours of labor into this model, and you're like, man, you know,
it's about to be 60 hours. That's true.
It's about to be 60 hours, because if it doesn't go right, it's going to be downhill. So
I think is it good enough, or do I want it? You know, do I want this model to look great, or is it good enough? And you have to be prepared for the consequences if you mess it up, but the payoff is worth it. Objects worth sliding with, especially with an airbrush. Like if you're just trying to make your headlights glow or what I did, it's so easy with an airbrush. Gosh, just get a dark shade of blue, a lighter shade of blue.
Let's hit the airbrush technique last. Let me bring up another brush technique, because I think where we're kind of going is how should this happen? Where should you put paint the color to represent this glow effect? And if you're unsure, typically the same way you highlight something, like the most raised things get a lot of the light, and you could show this by a flashlight shining across a table with some things on it, see where the light falls, whatever. You could also, instead of doing dry brushing, you could do some of this stuff with a paintbrush. Like, for instance, a plasma coil with like that rectangular box around it. You take your darker color, paint the plasma coil, and then get a little bit sloppy with it going on to the top of the, just around the edge. You're almost like edge highlighting where it meets the plasma coil with that darker color. So in this case, I think we can use green as our example. So you go dark green with that, do a lighter green, and you actually do edge highlight the lighter green on that. But this, you could even go a little bit further out, and you want to get the coils with that. And then you go in with the very brightest green or even a white on the actual coils itself. So it looks like your brightest color is centralized in the middle, and then it fades out, you know, progressively lighter or darker for the color.
The way I think about the color philosophy that you're talking about is I like to use the rule of three. So your dark color, think of that as light hitting things, but still shadows are playing on it, right? So that's going to be your darkest base. And then the actual color of the light itself is what's going to be your mid-tone. And then the focal point of where the light is coming from is what Paul's talking about with like that extreme bright or even white in that case. Hit, you know, because that's just, it's just so bright and so... Was the like emanating? That's a word, right?
That is a word. That is a word.
Yeah,
I don't know what it means.
Don't judge me. I feel like it worked. Roll with that for a moment.
What Troop just said, though, is that this is a 10-minute process. This is spending 10 more minutes on your figure to get this effect. You know, maybe an hour on a squad to get the effect across the whole thing, or less if you do it in assembly line. You know, you can achieve these effects even with the weathering, although I get it. I know I'm not supposed to, and I'm using the air quotes, do it at the end or as an afterthought. Hey, but sometimes that's just what happens.
I'm a less is more guy when it comes to this kind of stuff. I think that it really does bring models to life, but I also think that you have to build it up. So I'm kind of where Paul, I think his mindset is I like to do it all the way at the end, because I don't know if I want this squad to look like they just went through hell or not. Like, I don't know.
Well, you find your own style, right? So you'll find something that makes, and sometimes maybe it just speaks to you. And like, for instance, with the plague furnace, I wasn't sure what level I was going to. I know I wanted to do some things with the wood. Like I used some of the colored washes, like green and red wash, to give me some patina and variation in the wood things. I knew I was going to do that. But then it didn't really necessarily occur to me to rust up some of the spikes on this particular job until I looked at the box art. I was looking around for tutorials. I'm like, I mean, you know what? They did that and it really looks nice. And it was nothing to go back in and do a little bit of that stuff. With OSL, kind of the same thing. You could be getting up your whole squad. You're like, you know what? I got 10 more minutes left on this video I'm watching while I'm painting this podcast. Let me do something else. I'm gonna put this glow effect on this plasma or grav gun or whatever.
Well, that's the beauty of doing OSL. I mean, in almost every instance of it that I can think of, it's going to be the last thing you do before you seal your model, because you know, it's glowing, light is coming out of it. So you want to do that after you weather, because that glow is going to go over the dirt and over everything else. So you can have your whole army done and decide, oh, I want to give this a shot. You can pull your army back out and throw that extra effect on there, because it's not, you know, it's not interfering with anything else, because that light would be going over.
Did the same
that
thing.
Weather.
And that exactly harkens back to my original point, what I was saying earlier about, like, unlike weathering, you don't finish a model and say, I'm going to go ahead and weather now. Like, glow effects are, I have finished this model, and then you have to have this moment where you're like, well, there's in theory, there's going to be light emanating from this plasma gun. And am I going to actually put this light over the dark recesses of this cloak, the extreme edge highlighting. I mean, most of my models have two or three edge highlight colors on them. I'm going to have to glow effect over those edge highlights. All of those things have to be done. Exactly what Ricky just said. The glow effect is going to be the absolute last thing that goes on there.
But it's
and that's a real serious thing.
The kind of the whole thing is very intimidating. You know, I use my we'll talk about briefly about airbrushes, and I'm sure that Adam has some comments he'd like to share on this. So I don't want to like finish out the point on this, but I want to kind of at least touch on it. Is that one of the first things that I OSL'd was a Helldrake when the Helldrake model just came out. I painted this dude up, in my opinion, perfectly. He's a Nurgle Helldrake. But I want him like, you know what he's missing? Some, he's green, by the way, some glowing purple eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So how do I do that? How do I do this model that I just painted all this trim, this painfully, miles and miles of trim I just painted?
So much. I mean, if you do any edge highlighting, like a Helldrake and the Mauler Fiend / Forge Fiends, there's so much edge highlighting on them.
It's miles of trim.
It's like literally like allocate 8 years of your life.
Independent characters crack the code on that. You see that?
Yeah, Carl's great. He heard that on this show. We're talking about using the markers.
Sharpie.
Yeah, the Sharpie markers.
Yeah.
And he messaged me. He's like, where do I get those Sharpie markers? I was like, Amazon?
Walmart.
Yeah.
I'm ready to
I don't care. Sharpie markers might shave like a year or two off of the process, but you're still talking
it's still alive.
6 years. It's still like you've gotten engaged, married, and had your first kid between when you start and finish. Like that's
I know people who have gotten the first Helldrake and plan on getting three, and then after the first one they're like, nope.
No, I don't have two because I got them at the same time and I've never got the third for that exact reason. But anyway, I also magnetized it up, so I've got his head in my hand and I'm staring at it like how do I take this, and I've got my airbrush, okay, and I filled it with some purple paint. Like, so how do I convince myself to spray this purple paint all around his eye hole? And I just
gotta do it, man.
Yeah, that's it. I'm sitting there staring at both things. Yeah, it is. It's like, well, just do it. And this is, you know, on GMM suggestion, I just did it. I just hammered it down. I mean, I went light, and you want to build it up in layers. You just don't want to pull the hammer back and have it all blow out, you know? I did it in calculated, careful strokes, but in that pattern, that whole pattern of this is my darker color. It's going to be, you know, a little bit wider. And then I start dialing it in with the brighter and brighter and brighter till I finally get just a little bit of white and almost like a pink color that I use as more like an edge highlight with a brush. So I did two colors with the airbrush to get me that nice little glow. And then I brought it back out, for the epicenter, the emanation. Am I right, Troop? Am I using those right?
Yeah, yo, I'm all on board with all those words you just used.
With a brush. It feels good. Go with
it. Yeah. No, I was going to say though, this is like a little like hobby hack thing for you to kind of digest. Next time you're on YouTube and you're watching any airbrushing artist do like a fine detail, don't watch the model. Watch their hand on the airbrush. I like to call this like feathering. That's just how I associate it. If you watch their finger, they're constantly twitching their finger back while holding the air down, you know, for the dual action nozzles, of course. And it's just so ever so lightly just feathering in that color. So you're saturating it more and more and more and more. If you're going to airbrush OSL, you need to watch videos, watch their hands, and see exactly how that technique works. Because I think that is like that makes you're going to feel better. You know, when you go to do it and you put model in hand, you're going to feel better. I think you owe it to yourself to do it. Orc Painter Nerd is the most notorious one for doing that feathering with his finger. Oh,
that's where I learned my weathering, like all the techniques and products for weathering. That dude knows how to paint.
And let's do the PSA right now. If you all have that old GW Flamer airbrush, the single action airbrush, throw it in the trash and get a dual action.
It's time to get a new one.
You don't need like these $300 airbrushes. Get you like the $80 little Iwata.
We'll write an article about kind of get you by airbrush stuff and where you can get the best value out of it. That seems like a really good idea.
I will say it's actually interesting. And I mean, talking Troop just brought up a phenomenal point. You know, it's funny that I've heard professional sports commentators say essentially the same thing. Don't watch the play, watch an individual player. When you're watching those tutorial videos, don't necessarily watch the video where you're seeing the spray and the model and the guy and you hear the commentary. Like, watch an individual aspect of it. And it's tremendously beneficial. Mm-hmm. In the exact same way that if anyone has ever taken a golf lesson, or if you ever learned to fly fish, or if you know, they film your swing, for example, in golf. The same thing is true of painting techniques. You're probably doing it wrong, and you don't know it until you see yourself doing it. And I was this way for a very, very long time with the way I held my paintbrush. I held it very closely to like how you would hold a pencil, where my fingertips were very, very close to the bristles. Very, very close to the bristles. And my buddy and good friend of the show, world-class painter Thomas Bird, said to me, he's like, you're doing it wrong. You need to be holding the brush and like actually use it as a utensil. Your fingers are causing – your lines aren't as tight as they could be because you're over-controlling it. Like, and I didn't even think of that until he literally took a picture. He filmed me without me knowing it of like me painting. And I was like, and then he showed me the video, and I looked like a freaking noob. And I was like, wow, I guess that's really what
that
I'm
would explain
wrong.
These big eyes on this dude.
Exactly. Like, wow, this makes sense. Why none of my highlight lines are straight? So to the extent that you can kind of zero in on these painting tutorials, again, Adam Abramowitz, who's on the show, like obviously part of the FTN crew that does, you know, the Beyond the Brush crowd and whatever, whether you're doing the GW stuff with the Brush Liquor Society and everything else like that, like watch these episodes and really zero in on the nuances of them and the paint skill. You will be benefited by it tremendously if you start targeting your viewing.
I think you're exactly right. So let's go ahead and wrap this up. Next week, we're going to do this finishing move segment in some capacity, refined and defined by the questions that we get from folks out there listening. So if there's something you'd like to see in this segment, you want us to tighten up a little bit, you like it, you don't like it, let us know, because we want to make sure we're giving tips that are relevant to what a lot of people are doing out there. Next week, we actually got a question on display boards. So that's one of the things I think I want to cover for next week is how to, what's the purpose of a display board at a tournament, how to make one, and then the different categories of whatever your commitment level to that making it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough to talk about that because we're going to have to make a lot of time for Death Watch. But if we can squeeze it in,
Oh, you don't know how happy I am to see some of that stuff. I'm going to love Codex Frag Cannon.
There's a new flyer. Did you see it?
I saw the picture just now.
Oh,
that
my
thing
goodness.
Is insane.
Anyway, people are
guys,
you're,
I'm pumped. Like,
yes.
Pumped.
Thank you all for joining me tonight. We will talk soon. Have a good rest of y'all's day. Have a good weekend.
Peace.
Adios, homies.
Thanks for having me, guys. Bye.
Thanks for listening.